started?
Shall we? Quick opening prayer.
In the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. Amen. God of grace, we open our hearts, minds, and souls to worship you. Thank you that today we dwell in your kingdom and live in your presence. Thank you that as we gather together, we join with all Christians across the world to glorify your holy name. Come be with us, inspire us, and lead us in our time together. We ask all this in the beautiful name of Jesus. Amen.
Amen.
In the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. Amen. Take it away, Pat.
All right. So, for everyone who did get the email that I sent out yesterday, I said something pretty ambitious there, which is that we were going to try to go through four arguments today. I was going through the material, and then I decided, you know what? No, let's take it a little bit more relaxed than that. What we'll do instead is we'll just do two of the arguments today. And then next time we'll do the last two, and that'll close it out. I'd rather do that than rush through these arguments, because even though we're only doing them at an introductory level, there's still a lot to do here, and they're interesting enough that I want to take my time and have you guys take your time, feel like we can ask questions or do anything we want with them. Just a quick recap on what we've done so far, again, like I did last time. So the very first session, we talked about reformed epistemology. So the basic idea there is that you can, most of your beliefs are what philosophers would call properly basic beliefs, according to the reformed epistemologist. And so these are beliefs that you come to believe somewhat even unreflectively, just naturally in response to seeing the world. You believe there's an external world, you believe in the reality of the past, you believe in other minds, you believe almost everything you believe, you kind of believe in this knee-jerk way. And the idea of a properly basic belief is a belief that is formed in that natural way in response to the world, and that your cognitive faculties weren't malfunctioning when you formed the belief. There's no reason to think you were hallucinating when you formed the belief or anything like that. And so you ought to maintain the belief as perfectly reasonable, perfectly rationally warranted, even if you don't have especially good philosophically clever arguments for it. You don't need philosophically clever arguments to have a good reason for believing something that seems just natural to you in response to looking at the world. And one of the beliefs that we looked at as being properly basic is belief in God. So belief in God's existence can be one of those beliefs that's properly basic. That doesn't mean that it's indefeasible. That doesn't mean nobody could ever abandon it. It just means that in order to abandon a properly basic belief, you have to be given some good reason to think that you're wrong about it, that you're probably incorrect about it, and then it would be time for you to revise it. But unless somebody presents a reason to think that you're wrong about it, you're perfectly within your rights to maintain a basic belief. Okay, so that'll give, for those of you who are new and just joining us for the first time, that'll give a little bit of context for something I intend to say with one of today's arguments. And then the arguments that we've looked at so far have been cosmological arguments. So those are arguments that pick out some feature of the cosmos and say that feature is in need of explanation, whether it's the fact that there is motion of certain kinds or whether it's the fact that the universe began to exist, that seems to cry out for an explanation, or the fact that it exists at all, right? Why is there something rather than nothing is Leibniz's question. So these are features of the cosmos that seem to cry out for an explanation. And cosmological arguments try to suggest that the best explanation, if maybe the only explanation, but certainly the best explanation, is that it is in terms of God's existence. So you can appeal to God and say, this is a perfectly good reason for concluding to that God exists. And then we looked at the philosopher's trick argument, the ontological argument, which tries to derive God's existence from the concept of God. So it takes the concept of God as a maximally great being, and then tries to show that if you just reflect carefully enough on what that really entails, you'll be able to see, or should be able to see, that it's going to entail the existence of that being. Maybe it doesn't entail it directly, if existence isn't a first-order property, but it can still maybe entail it indirectly by numbering among these great-making properties, like omniscience and omnipotence and omnibenevolence and so on. Maybe it lists necessity, right, or incontingency. If something exists necessarily, if that's the mode in which it exists, then from the possibility that it exists, you can derive that it does in fact exist. That's kind of how the ontological argument goes. Okay, the very first time I said that there are a number of different arguments for God's existence and even different kinds of arguments for God's existence. And the three broad categories that I gave you guys at the very beginning were cosmological arguments, those are the first two that we looked at, ontological arguments, which try to go from the concept of God, and then the third kind is called a teleological argument. And most of you have probably, you're probably familiar with some form of this, even if the word sounds very abstruse, it's definitely a philosopher's term. But what a teleological argument is, basically, is an argument from design, or at least from the appearance of design in the world. So cosmological arguments might pick out a feature of the universe, like the fact that it exists, and call it for an explanation. Teleological arguments look at features of the world that appear as though they are designed, right? If we didn't know any better, we would just naturally infer that those were the products of design. And then the question arises, well, what kind of designer could there be behind nature itself, behind the world as we see it? And then the best candidate for that, it turns out, probably is God or something very, very close to God. And so we're going to be looking at a teleological argument tonight. That's going to be the second one. But the first argument we're going to look at actually doesn't fall into any one of these categories. It's kind of a category unto itself, and it's a moral argument for God's existence. So, out of curiosity, has anybody ever heard of a moral argument for God's existence before? Anybody familiar with it? Or will this be completely new and fresh for everybody?
Don't know.
Don't know? Okay.
Sure,
yeah.
I heard of morals, but,
yeah.
Don't know about moral argument.
Right. Okay. Okay, all right, so this will be fun. It looks like it'll be completely fresh. So how does a moral argument for God's existence go? A moral argument, or a version of a moral argument for God's existence, can go something like this. First premise, there are objective moral truths. So as we go about our day and we have moral experiences along with other kinds of experiences, we naturally seem to apprehend that there are certain moral facts in the world. Lying to somebody who, you know, it would clearly be wrong to lie to is wrong. Torturing a small innocent baby is wrong. Those seem like obvious and not just true in some conventional sense, but true in a hard sense that's like, this is a fact, and if somebody doesn't agree with it, it's not just that our tastes differ. Like disagreeing about whether apple pie is better than, you know, chocolate cake or something like that. It seems like somebody is actually wrong about reality if they say that those things are not objectively wrong. So the first premise in this argument maintains that there really are these kinds of facts out there in the world, that there are moral facts, facts about things that are morally good or bad. And this is the case objectively. So by objectively here, we mean something like independently of what anyone perceives or believes, independently, that's the way that William Lane Craig puts it in his moral argument. Or you can even just think of it as independently of anything, any contingent state of affairs. So it doesn't just happen to be the case that it's wrong to torture an innocent child. It's wrong in every situation. It's not like you could have arranged the circumstance differently so that it would have been right in some wild scenario. No, it's wrong everywhere and always, or so it seems to be. Right? That's a very strong and very common moral intuition that most people have, and most people share that, and I think we get that naturally from our moral experience. So that's the first premise of this argument, is there really are objective moral truths out there in the world. They're just as real as the truths of physics. They're different kinds of truths, but they're just as true about the reality we encounter in our experience. The second premise is that if God did not exist, there would not be objective moral truths. So here, the premise is suggesting that in the absence of God's existence, there's nothing in which we can actually ground these moral truths. So if you remember, I mentioned at one point that there's a kind of what's called a correspondence theory of truth. This is, again, a kind of intuitive theory of truth. It's not the only one, but I do think it's the right one, and it's the common sense one, which says something like, when I say a statement like snow is white, what makes that true is a truth maker out in the world, namely snow's being white. That's what makes that kind of statement true. And you can think then about the kinds of truth makers that you have for a variety of propositions. What's the truth maker for 2 + 2 = 4? Well, people are confused about that, but this is the reason we have mathematical Platonists who think that numbers really exist as part of the fabric of reality. They're abstract and material objects, but they have to exist, and they act as the truth makers for these kinds of mathematical propositions. Alternatively, you might say that, you know, these correspond to thoughts in the mind of God. God's mind is necessary, and so he can ground necessary facts if he has thoughts necessarily. So you could kind of pull that move that's kind of called divine conceptualism. But whatever account you give of what makes it true that 2 + 2 = 4, you presumably want to be able to map some correspondence between the proposition and the world out there. Okay, so then what about moral truths? What makes it true that it is always and everywhere wrong to torture an innocent person? What's the thing that makes that true objectively? The difficulty here is that you're not going to be able to say something like, well, we've all decided, right? We've all just agreed that that's wrong. Well, okay, we probably should all agree that that's wrong, but that can't be what grounds the truth of its being wrong, because we could have thought otherwise, right? Had we just had a different culture, or had we been psychologically very different from the way we are as human beings, maybe we could have thought that it is right. In fact, I mean, you can just survey philosophers, and for any wild proposition, there's at least one philosopher out there who thinks it. So you could probably find at least one person who thinks, actually, it is not objectively wrong. In fact, there are very many philosophers who would say that. So even with us, even with respect to our psychology, it's at least thinkable that those things would be right, even though to most of us that seems unacceptable and it's just off the table. It shouldn't be seriously considered. All right, so we can't ground it in ourselves, either by our conventions or even by our natures, right? Some philosophers will try to say, well, evolution has just made us such that we have to prefer certain things to others. We can't not prefer those things. And so because it's just universal that we prefer these things, we'll call them good. And that we don't like these other things, we'll call them bad. Even if that kind of argument were successful, you could easily imagine our natures having been different. You could have run the tape of evolution backwards and come up with a creature that was completely different from us. Or maybe there's an alien race like us that's just, but it just has a completely different constellation of moral beliefs, because they're just completely different from anything like us. So that doesn't give us the kind of objectivity that most of us feel when, for example, let's say you're walking down the street and you see somebody kick a pregnant woman in the stomach. None of us stop to think, what makes that wrong? What's the deduction to prove that? No, you feel it in your gut immediately that is wrong. Whatever the philosophical reasoning is, that is wrong. And if any philosophically clever argument tries to convince somebody that it's not wrong, it's mistaken. It's gone wrong somewhere, because that's clearly wrong, and we kind of know that intuitively. But in the absence of God, is there anything in which you can actually ground these truths? What serves as the truth maker for there being moral truths objectively, in the strong sense of objective, independent of us, independent of convention, independent of some contingent state of affairs in the world, whatever that is? In what other than God could you ground these kinds of moral truths? Seems like God is probably the best candidate for this. And so you get an argument that very clearly and quickly concludes to God's existence. So again, first premise, there are objective moral truths. Second, if God did not exist or does not exist, then there would not be and could not be objective moral truths. So it follows, therefore God exists. Okay. I actually used to think that this argument was a terrible argument. I didn't think it was very good, because I thought that even though anyone who already believes that God exists should accept this argument as sound, the premises seem true, the conclusion follows logically from the premises, so seems like you've got a valid argument, and it's even a sound argument because the premises are true, so the conclusion is true. But the question is, can the argument be used to persuade anybody? And I used to think, no, probably not. And the reason for this is even going back to when I nearly became an atheist and I was thinking through these things for the first time, really. I thought if I were an atheist, if I were a naturalist, I would probably just reject this kind of moral objectivity, or what's called moral realism. So yes, we feel it in our gut that, you know, certain things really are right and certain things really are wrong, but probably the best explanation for that is that it's to our evolutionary advantage that we have those kinds of shared strong intuitions, and so we would naturally evolve them, but that doesn't give us good reason to think they're objectively true as some part of reality out there. And if we're going to take atheism seriously, maybe what we should do is just take seriously moral nihilism, right? This view that actually it's not the case that there are anything like objective moral truths. Really, disagreements about moral principles and intuitions come down to something like a difference in taste. And so you can't really argue about them. You can disagree with people about them. You can disagree plenty. But you can't really argue about them as though you're arguing about, you know, the truth or falsity of a model in physics or something like that. It's not the kind of thing that could be true or false, because you're throwing it out as a projection onto the world when it's actually just a kind of emotive thing. And so I thought any atheist, and this is very typical among the great atheists. So if you think about Nietzsche or Jean-Paul Sartre or other famous, very high-profile atheists in the history of philosophy, this is the conclusion that they are led to. They're led to a kind of moral nihilism, a kind of moral anti-realism that says, yeah, we got rid of God, and we are going to bite the bullet. There is no way to ground objective moral truths, but we can still get by because most of us agree or can be made to agree on certain moral sentiments, right? We can argue with others until they share our moral sentiments, we can get them to share. And so if all we want morality for is to help us get by in the world and make the world better for ourselves and others, we can probably get everything we really need without this kind of abstract commitment to objectivity, to real objective moral truths. That's what I used to think. I no longer think this, and part of what changed my mind is that I realized that it's actually just a sociological fact about human beings in general and about atheists, including very, very good atheistic philosophers, that most people are profoundly, profoundly committed to moral realism. They don't want to give up moral realism. It takes a very special kind of person to be like Jean-Paul Sartre or Russell, and to say, yeah, I'm just going to embrace moral anti-realism of one kind or another. I'm going to reject the objectivity of moral truths, even though that seems highly intuitive. I just don't accept that, and it's a consequence of my views, including that God doesn't exist. Most atheists will not do that. In fact, there's an atheist philosophy, a philosopher, Louise Antony, very good philosopher, and she had a debate on this topic once with William Lane Craig. William Lane Craig gave his version of the moral argument, and Antony's response to it, and even just thinking about it in the debate, was really interesting, because she said she was not going to embrace moral anti-realism. She would not be led to embrace moral anti-realism, and she even came out and said, if you gave me an argument for moral anti-realism, its premises would have to be less plausible to me than moral realism. So no matter what argument you give me, I'm going to end up thinking that the premises that you're using have to be less plausible than moral realism. So in a sense, whether or not she worked out a metaphysical account of how there could be objective moral truths didn't matter. She was fundamentally committed to the project of finding them because there are some out there. There must be. And I didn't realize this until later on when really engaging people about this argument, but most people, including most very thoughtful atheists, will concede that first premise, that there are objective moral truths. So the one part of the argument that I thought an atheist would just do away with and not think twice about it is the part of the argument that atheists are, as a matter of fact, least likely to want to give up, and that other people, just in general, agnostics and so on, are also least likely to want to give up. Almost all of us have a kind of strong commitment to moral realism. And so that was probably the first thing that started to change my mind about this argument, and I started thinking about it as a more serious argument, probably as serious as any other argument for God's existence. I mean, for any argument that you present, not just for God's existence, but for literally anything, it's always going to be possible for somebody to disagree with a premise in your argument. But the question is, at what cost do they avoid the conclusion? So in a cosmological argument from contingency, the cost of avoiding the conclusion might be that you embrace what we call brute facts. So facts that are true, that are not necessary, and for which there is no explanation. Not just that we don't have an explanation, but that there's literally no explanation for these kinds of facts, brute facts. Well, you could avoid the conclusion that God exists in that argument by going that way, but it comes at a kind of philosophical cost. And so, in a sense, what we do when we construct arguments is we say, here's a good reason for thinking the following, and if you want to avoid the conclusion, either you show where our argument is logically invalid, where the conclusion doesn't follow from the premises, or you're going to have to deny at least one of the premises. But if it's hard to deny the premises, if that comes at a cost, then there's a kind of an exchange that goes on. You're going to have to make a decision about which of these seems more plausible to you. And to most people, it turns out, moral realism is extremely plausible. People do not want to give it up unless they absolutely have to. And that includes most, not all, but most thoughtful atheists who confront this argument will say, that's not where we're going to disagree with this argument. So, yeah.
But what would be an atheist's, explanations for believing moral realism?
Right, right, good. So we are going to go through some. I'll get to those in a bit, because there are some accounts that have been worked out by atheists who want to secure for themselves objective moral realism. But most atheists, even without a good model for metaphysically grounding moral truths, even in the absence of that, they'll say, well, the fact that I don't have a model doesn't mean that there isn't one out there. What I'm going to do is show you that your model of trying to ground it in God will be unsuccessful. And if I can do that, then I've still kind of diffused the argument by showing you that you can't, you know, you theists, you can't really get what you want. You want to say that you could ground it in God, and that's sort of it, that's the end of the story. But maybe there are problems with doing that. And so if we can show you there's a problem with doing that, then you're on the same footing as us. You don't have any account either. But don't you want to be a moral realist? Yes? Okay, so then we're moral realists even though we don't have a good account. Atheists will do the same thing as well with respect to things like, we're not going to go through this argument, but there's an argument from consciousness, right, where a lot of philosophers have pointed out that it's actually gotten harder and harder rather than easier and easier to try to account for consciousness in anything like a naturalistic or materialistic way. The problem has actually just gotten worse from the 1950s onwards, not easier as a lot of people expected it to be. Well, now it seems to many people virtually impossible to explain consciousness on anything like materialism or physicalism, or just naturalism more broadly. But many naturalists are holding on to the hope that, well, someday we're going to crack that case. We're going to get the right kind of combination of philosophy and neuroscience, and we're going to figure out how consciousness works and how it's not only correlated to physical brain states, but how you can reduce one to the other, how one of them at least emerges from the other, how that could even possibly happen. So even without an account, they'll still say, we're hopeful that there will be an account someday. Our not having an account doesn't mean we can't have a rational belief, right? So they just will hold the rational belief and say, yeah, the project of coming up with an account, we're interested in that. We don't want to do it using God, but even if we haven't figured it out yet, that doesn't mean that we give up on moral realism. We wouldn't give up on anything else that way either. That's probably what they would say. Yeah?
Yes, Hunter, have you ever heard the argument somebody would say for survival, for the community over time,
mm-hmm.
you know, we would have developed these moral truths, to use your example, because we kicked the pregnant baby, because we tortured the child, we don't have enough labor
yeah.
to work the land. That doesn't really work, so can we come together and decide, okay, we don't do that anymore. Don't try and say like a kind of a deduced
yeah.
moral reason.
Yeah. There are some who have tried to give that kind of account. And some people are satisfied with that kind of account. The problem with that account is that, as we said earlier, that doesn't really give you the kind of objectivity that most of us think we apprehend in our moral experience. That when we say it's wrong, and objectively wrong, we don't mean because there are certain contingent facts about the way evolution ran its course, right? That it could be that it really just is an evolutionary spin-off, or maybe that it's evolutionarily entailed for a species like ours or something like that. But that's gonna rob you of the kind of objectivity that most people, at least intuitively, feel moral facts have. The same kind of thing can be said about mathematics. In fact, you can run a parallel argument, right? Somebody who's an anti-realist about mathematics will say, well, evolution would have fashioned us to have these kinds of mathematical beliefs, but that doesn't mean that we should be realists about mathematics. Yeah, you can do the same thing, but that's not going to be a very convincing argument for anyone who's doing philosophy of math and trying to figure out what numbers really are, if they exist at all. Just giving an evolutionary explanation of how we've come to believe in numbers, at least a plausible story about why we would believe in numbers, that doesn't tell you whether they're real or not. Right? I can tell you an evolutionary story about how I came to the belief that there are other minds. It doesn't follow from that there are not other minds in the world. Right? So you can't really use evolution to argue for anti-realism without doing a little bit more work than just saying evolution explains it, that's the end of the story. And even if it did explain it, it might not give you the account that you actually want if you're really a realist about any of these things. Like, moral realists want to say it's really wrong or it's really right in a way that's a lot stronger. Okay, so just a few things about this argument before I give probably the most well-known criticism of the argument. A few things to say about it. So first, if somebody really does question the premise that there are objective moral truths, one of the things that I think you can do in response, or it seems to me to be a legitimate move to make in response, is to say, well, it seems to me that belief in moral realism is properly basic. And here I don't just mean that you think it's properly basic, so you're justifying your realism to the person you're talking to. I mean that you should probably also recommend that attitude for them. Don't you think there are properly basic beliefs? And if there are properly basic beliefs, don't you think these moral realist beliefs would be among them? You naturally form that belief in your moral experience. You don't have any good reason to think it's wrong, right? Or at least in the absence of having a good reason to think it's wrong, it seems perfectly reasonable to accept that it's right. So that's maybe one way that you can try to give some support for that first premise in the argument. Another thing you could do is just to say, look, it's pretty costly to give that up, right? Even if it weren't a properly basic belief, this seems like something you probably don't want to give up unless you really have to. So what's the argument for giving it up? It better not just be something like theophobia, right? That you're so afraid of the conclusion that God exists that you'll do anything to avoid it, including just embracing moral anti-realism. Then you're not really interested in truth. You're interested in maybe winning an argument or avoiding a certain kind of conclusion that you don't like for whatever reason. But if that's the way you're going to go about things, that's not reasoning in search of truth, right? That's reasoning for the sake of safeguarding the beliefs that you've chosen because you're comfortable with them. And all of us, whether you're a theist, an atheist, religious or not, everyone should be careful about not doing that too easily or casually or often, because it's important, again, for good intellectual hygiene, if nothing else, that you be able to think critically about your beliefs and not just defend whatever seems to you right. I mean, that's one of the reasons why it's good to not feel like you have to defend every argument for God's existence, even if you believe in God, right? You can look at any of the arguments, or even maybe all of them, and say, these arguments don't work. I still think it's reasonable to think God exists, but none of these arguments work, right? That's a potentially a perfectly reasonable position to take. And so we should feel at liberty to take it, and then when we're presented with an argument, the attitude should be, well, let's see what we can learn from it. Let's see what about reality it might reveal to us if we think through it carefully enough. So those are some things you can say. The last thing that you can say, and this is something that I remember discussing this with another student, a philosophy student at the time. Both of us were undergrads, and he was just absolutely staunchly an anti-realist. Like, he just did not think there were moral truths. And I said, well, why do you think there are not moral truths? And he started saying things about how, well, people don't agree about moral truths. And I said, yeah, people don't agree about plenty of things. And it named, you know, a contentious scientific theory that he would think is true, right? Whether it be about evolutionary theory or climate change or whatever, right? He's liable to think, well, this is just, it's inarguable, it's obviously right. Well, there are people who disagree about that. Does that give you a good reason to abandon that belief? Probably not, right? At least you don't think so, unless you're ready to abandon those beliefs. So there's got to be more to your story than just other people disagree. And then I kind of turned it around on him when I suggested, for any reason that you give me for rejecting moral realism, I can run a parody reason. I can give you an almost identical reason for rejecting the existence of the external world. Right? I can just come up with a reason for thinking there is no objective reality out there in anything like the intuitive sense that there really is a physical table out there. It's not just an object in my imagination or my mind or something like that. And he said, well, I don't think you can. I said, try. Right? So if you try to think of an argument against moral realism that can't be parodied, I think you're going to have actually a very, very difficult time. Any argument against moral realism seems, to me, at least potentially capable of being parodied into an argument against realism about the external world. Most people don't want to give up realism about the external world either. So doesn't that mean that there has to be, either you have to do more work to abandon the belief reasonably, or you shouldn't have abandoned the belief in the first place. Maybe that move was mistaken and you should go back and embrace it. So those are ways to kind of motivate that first premise, the premise that there really are objective moral truths. But, yeah, go ahead.
Well, I don't want to interrupt you.
No, go.
But, so when you were phrasing moral realism, you said, said it's something like that there are moral truths that are objective.
Objective.
There are, so there exist,
mm-hmm.
but there's no statement about how many or
right.
how important. I mean,
right.
what I mean is, like, you know, perhaps we can all agree that, you know, like, torture is almost bad, but then maybe we can't say much else in the sense that, you know, some people might say there's a core of things, but then it doesn't go much further than that.
Right, okay. So it's important to understand the strategy, or a good strategy in a philosophical argument, is minimalism. You want it to be the case that with as minimal a commitment as possible, you can still run the entire argument. So suppose somebody says, there are no objective moral truths out there, it's all convention, except that you can't torture an innocent person. Okay, good enough, good enough. There's at least one objective moral truth. How do you ground that one, right? Maybe most people want to believe there are more than that, and then there are real arguments between people about what moral principles we should actually hold to, what your account of morality consists of. But this is an argument that it takes a step back from all of that. You can disagree with other people about what things are in fact morally obligatory, morally good or morally bad, but if anybody thinks that there really are such things as objective moral truths, then this argument can be run. It doesn't even matter what they think the moral truths are, right? They might think completely differently from you. They might think that, oh, I don't know, suppose somebody thinks that to be religious in any sense, to be Catholic, is immoral, right? And this is just an objective moral principle. Okay, fine, doesn't matter. You think that being Catholic is objectively immoral. You believe that there are objective moral truths. The argument should work. You're going to have to do something about getting out of the argument or just accept the conclusion that God exists, right? And that might inch you at least a little closer towards Catholicism or something. So it really doesn't matter what somebody is committed to in terms of what beliefs they regard as moral. If they have any moral beliefs at all, well, and they really think they're objective, then the argument is on the table for them. They're gonna still have to deal with it.
But will we discuss, I guess it's not really relevant, but it does seem to lead rather naturally into discussion of like moral relativism versus moral absolutism.
Right. Yeah, okay, so at least if somebody means by moral relativism the rejection of objective moral truths, they're not talking about that. You could use relativism in different ways, right? So you might say that there are objective moral principles, but how those play out from one situation to another, right? That there's something called in ethics situationalism. You could have serious disagreements about that. So even, for example, somebody might say there are utilitarians out there. A utilitarian is somebody whose ethical theory says that the right thing to do is to increase or maximize human happiness and minimize human suffering, right? That's a kind of basic commitment to utilitarianism. I think utilitarianism is wrong, but put that aside. There are very many people who think utilitarianism is right. So a utilitarian might say, well, I can imagine a situation where torturing an innocent person is the right thing to do, right? So a bunch of terrorists have you locked in a room, and they say, if you don't torture this little child, I'm going to set off a nuclear bomb, right? So millions upon millions of innocent people will die unless you torture this one innocent person. Now, if you're a committed utilitarian and you're persuaded that what the terrorists are telling you is actually true, you might think, even if it's distasteful to you, it's your moral obligation now to torture the child. Okay, well, again, that seems counterintuitive to most of us. Not everyone is a utilitarian. I don't think you should be a utilitarian. I think this exemplifies what utilitarianism gets wrong. But even if you're a utilitarian, if you're committed to the objective truth of utilitarianism, then you're still a moral realist in the relevant sense, so we can still run this argument. Okay, so that gives you kind of a basic introduction to the argument, and it motivates the first premise. The second premise seems plausible, but before I defend it, I actually just want to give what is probably the most popular, well-known argument against it, and it's known as the Euthyphro dilemma. And this is actually from Socratic dialogues back in the writings of Plato. So the Euthyphro dilemma is something that Euthyphro, the person or character, Euthyphro actually asks, do the gods will something because it is good, or is something good because the gods will it? And you can change this to, you can give this a monotheistic expression. So does God will something because it is good, or is something good merely because God wills it. And there's a problem in either direction here, because if something is good only because God wills it, then God could have willed anything, right? He could have willed the torture of innocent people, and then that would have been good. But that seems highly counterintuitive, and then it also means that we don't get moral objectivism in the sense that we started with anyways, because God just gets to decide what's morally right or wrong. It's completely up to him. It's arbitrary. It's based on his will. And had his will been different, well, then moral truths would have been different. But that robs us of objective morality. So the atheist will say, well, not only can you not ground it in God, but you actually, if you're going to be committed to God's existence, you can't be a moral realist. So the problem is even worse for you than it is for me. Or the other thing, the other way you could go is to say, well, God wills something because it is good. And that sounds a little bit more intuitive, but the problem with that is that something will be good or not independently of God. So what was the sense in saying that you could ground it somehow in God? Either God wills it because it's good, in which case it's good independently of God, or it's good only because God wills it, in which case we don't have moral objectivism anyways, because it's all just arbitrary. It's not arbitrarily up to us conventionally, but it is just up to God. It could have been anything he willed.
But if God is love,
yeah,
or God is total perfection, perfect being, whatever,
yeah,
then isn't it moral?
Okay, so I agree with what I think you're thinking, but you won't be able to say that it's both. In fact, you won't be able to say that it's either one, strictly speaking, because neither of them, first of all, they are really opposed to each other, right? These are two different accounts of how to ground goodness, or in what goodness is grounded. One of them says that it's grounded in whatever God wills. The other one says whatever it's grounded in has to be independent of God. So those two can't be true at the same time and in the same sense, right? But I think your intuition is actually right. And this leads to what I think is the right way to respond to this dilemma, which is to what philosophers call splitting the horns of the dilemma. So arguably, this is not actually a true dilemma. In a true dilemma, you have two options, and there are no other possible alternatives, right? So you have two options, and that exhausts all the options that you have. That's a genuine dilemma. But here, there might be other alternatives. And the most plausible one, the one that has been resurrected as of late, as philosophers have started thinking more about this, it was actually really resurrected by somebody named William Alston, although he's not alone in this realization. He realized, essentially what the insight is, what he realized was, in grounding goodness in God, what you can and probably should do is say that it's grounded in God's nature, which is to say that goodness is not grounded in God's will, one way or another. Rather, his will always be to will the good. Why? Not because it's grounded in what he wills, because it's grounded in his very nature, and his will be an expression of that nature. So, God is a necessary being, exists across all possible worlds, as we saw last time with both of the arguments we looked at. But that also means that whatever God is like, he's also like that across all possible worlds. If he's all-powerful, then he's all-powerful in all possible worlds. If he's all-knowing, he's all-knowing in all possible worlds. And if he is good, and not just that he happens to be good, but that he is the ground of goodness itself, he is paradigmatically good, as philosophers say, well then he is that way across all logically possible worlds too. He's going to be that way necessarily. So the way to split the horns of this dilemma, plausibly at least, is just to say, of God, that God is, God's nature is identical to the good. Now, it's important to point out that this identity claim is, it, this is a claim of, like we saw last time, metaphysical identity. This is not a claim about conceptual identity, as though you couldn't think about goodness without thinking about God. I mean, all of us think about goodness all the time without necessarily thinking about God. The atheist can think about goodness without thinking about God. So it's not a claim that in order to think about one, you have to think about the other, or that the concepts imply each other, or something like that. Rather, this is more like the claim that water is identical to H2O. Is that actually the case? Yes, we now know that water is H2O. But in advance of knowing anything about its molecular structure, we all knew what water was, right? So even when you were a kid, or when humanity didn't have the science as it is today, we all knew perfectly well what water was, even though we didn't know that it was identical to H2O. Now we do know that the best account of water that we have is that it is identical to H2O. That's what water is. That's the sense in which we mean that there's an identity here between goodness considered in itself and God considered in himself. What we're saying is that God is actually identical to the good. Not that you have to think about one when you think about the other, but that in objective reality, one is the other. They are identical in the same way that water is H2O. So this is the way in which you can argue that objective moral truths can be grounded in God. And this will give you everything that you want if you're looking for objective moral realism, because God exists across all logically possible worlds, and you want your moral principles to hold as true across all possible worlds. Well, grounding it in God will then give you that, right? Yeah.
I'm sorry to pick on the water H2O thing, but when it comes to like water H2O as a concept, right, we could conceive that once we knew enough about both those things and we understood their equality, we could replace in any situation one for the other. We could say, oh, pass me that H2O, I'm going to H2O my lawn. we could replace one for the other as needed, but we can't do that with goodness and God, at least I don't think we can.
Well, I mean, it does seem like there is, there might be a problem conventionally. We don't usually conventionally mean, oh, that thing that you did is God-like, right? Or something like that. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, it's still open to us, even though that's not a conventional way of speaking. The question is not whether our linguistic conventions match onto or map well onto what we're suggesting here as a metaphysical account. But the question is just, does it make sense in any instance? So if you point to something and you say, that's good, does it make sense for you to mean by that, that is like God in some way, right? Or that is intimating the divine nature.
But you see, they're God in some way, because
yes,
God has more than just the goodness. So it's almost like
right,
a superset.
Right.
Less
yes, than a yes, yes, right. That's okay. So there's another good point here. When we say identity here, it's important to say that identity here will not have to mean is nothing other than, right? And again, descriptively, so okay, there's a very, very deep question. I'm kind of dancing around it because I think we probably don't want to get into it, but just to give you a taste for it, there is a serious issue about what's called the doctrine of divine simplicity, which will suggest that in God's case, God does not have parts. God is not composed of properties. There's no metaphysical ingredient list for God's nature or anything like that. But what some philosophers will point out is that seems to mean that if God is identical to these properties that we say he has, like all powerfulness, well then, God just is a property, right? If you're identical to a property, then you are a property. And there's a whole discussion about this in philosophy of religion on is it actually possible to get away from the subjection, to say that there's a certain sense in which two things can be identical without saying that that identity is all-encompassing, that if one thing is identical to another and it is identical to a third, then there's a kind of transitivity of identity. There are good reasons for actually denying that. So you would have to go into very carefully, wade into the waters of identity and what accounts of identity you have. So I'm just punting at this point to say we probably will look at that at some very later point, but for our purposes, it should be enough to say that identity here does not mean is nothing other than, or should be considered nothing other than. That's the first point. The second point is that we have to also make a distinction between metaphysical identity and that kind of conceptual identity. So to say that God is metaphysically identical to the good is not to say, even if you have a very strict view of identity, it's not to say that God is descriptively identical to the good. Right? That may not hold if you have a very strong view of identity, which is going to imply that God is nothing other than goodness. Right? He's more than goodness. But the metaphysical identity is not the same as this kind of conceptual identity. It's difficult to tease those apart because most of the time, those go together, right? Like with H2O and water. Most of the time when things are identical, they're identical in both of these ways. But there is a way to distinguish identity in the one case and identity in the other, and to say that they're not always coextensive. They're not always picking out the same things. So that's two maybe unsatisfying for the moment ways of trying to deal with that. One of them is to say your theory of identity could be questioned, and the other is to say we're blurring the lines between descriptive identity and metaphysical identity. So for our purposes, again, what we're really concerned with here is metaphysical identity. We want to say that in God's nature, you can ground the objectivity of moral goodness, and that is because God's nature is necessary, so it will give you objectivity, and it is good. In fact, it's arguably the paradigm of goodness. It is the measure of goodness. So something else is good to the extent that it matches up to or is measured against God's nature. And that seems intuitively like a pretty plausible account of objective moral realism. So that's something you could say in defense of that then second premise. Okay. Are there any other questions? Yeah? Okay. So very quickly before we go to break, so that lays out for you at least a teaser for the moral argument. And again, I think, there is something where we have to do with this argument, actually. I almost forgot, I can't believe I forgot. I just said that I was gonna give some atheistic accounts of moral realism. So as I said at the beginning, most atheists do not actually embrace moral nihilism. They absolutely reject it, with or without an account of moral realism. But some atheists do want an account of moral realism. They want to be able to cash out the claim that there really are objective moral truths, but they can't appeal to God in order to do it. So what does their account look like? Well, one account, there are a few different accounts that are on offer, but one account that's on offer comes from this guy named Eric Weilenberg. And he is what you call a moral Platonist. So just like there are mathematical Platonists who think that numbers really exist, he is a moral Platonist in the sense that he thinks there are these objective moral truths or objective moral values or objective moral properties, and that they really exist out there in reality. And so he grounds the objectivity of moral truths and moral values and so on in these abstract objects. Okay. This is a very clever, interesting, metaphysically extravagant way of trying to get moral realism without appealing to God. there are a number of problems with it. So the most obvious problem is that it kind of violates what's called Occam's razor. So Occam's razor says that you shouldn't multiply entities beyond necessity, or something like if you have two explanations and one of them just involves a lot more entities or a lot more hypotheses or a lot more of something than the other one does, there are different kinds of simplicity, then you ought to, all things being equal, they offer, both of these explanations are perfectly good, right? They're just as good as each other, but one of them is bloated, so to speak. It involves all these extra entities. Well, then you ought to pick the one that is simpler. It involves the fewest entities possible and still do the explanatory work that you wanted it to do, and that will make your explanation more elegant. Okay, so let's say that this is a real, genuine way of getting moral realism on atheism. All right, so we can concede it without even going into any other problems. This is a real way to get objective moral realism on atheism. How does it fare when compared to theism? Well, theism posits one necessary being, not infinitely many abstract necessary beings, or even finitely many, but very many abstract entities, or anything like that. So theism, by comparison, is much simpler, and it's also not as ad hoc, as it were. The reason we say it's not as ad hoc, the reason is that we have other motivations for thinking that God exists. Right? So think about the other arguments we already had for thinking God exists. That gives us independent motivation for thinking that God or something very, very much like God exists. Since we already had those reasons in place, it seems like theism here just does a better job. It's a simpler explanation. It's better motivated for completely other reasons, and it doesn't feel metaphysically extravagant or like it was just made up to avoid admitting that God exists, but still get moral realism. And so there are these advantages. You don't have to say, though, that the atheist has made necessarily a mistake or that they're doing something wrong if they opt for this kind of account. I think it's perfectly fine to just say, yeah, that's a possible account of moral realism, and it's just not as good as ours. It's just not as good as a theistic account. So I don't think it should be accepted. But there is at least one other problem with it, or at least a possible problem with it. Not that Grillenberg doesn't have responses to this, but I think that this is a serious problem for the view. You might be able to get objective moral facts out of a view like this, or objective moral values out of a view like this, but it's actually very difficult to get all of the moral properties that we experience in our moral experience. So for example, most of us feel like we don't only just know that there are moral truths, we understand that we have moral duties, right? Well, when you think about what a duty is, how could an impersonal abstract object bestow on you a duty, right? To whom or what do you owe a duty? It seems like a duty is something that you have to owe a person. On this abstract view, where there are just these Platonic objects, it's very difficult to tell a story on which I have any objective moral duties. Sure, maybe objective moral values you can get, but objective moral duties seems like I can't have duties to impersonal abstract objects that don't think anything or care at all about me or anything else in the world, right? Whereas if your theory, like theism, posits that there is a person at the foundation of reality, that God is goodness and is also personal, well then you've got a plausible account of how you could possibly owe duties that would be objective, that maybe you owe God certain duties, or you owe duties to others in a way that's objective because God requires it of you, right? That you love your neighbor as yourself, for example. And in that case, you can actually get a richer moral landscape than even the landscape that the moral Platonist can get. So the moral Platonist has a very extravagant story. They've multiplied entities way beyond necessity to try to get moral realism and to do it on atheism. And so even if they have done it successfully, probably it's a depreciated return because they don't get objective moral duties. And most of us feel like those are also part of our moral experience. We do know that those are part of the moral reality in the world. So, okay, yes, yeah.
So how would this atheist justify the idea that we know what these moral truths are?
Right, so
why
there's...
If they exist,
yeah.
How would they then naturally arise through evolution or whatever?
Right, so this is actually another problem with the kind of moral Platonist view, is what kind of story can you tell to hook up our moral intuitions or our moral experience with these abstract objects. But I wanna be charitable here. Maybe there's a story you could tell. And in any case, that problem that is the moral Platonist is gonna face that problem. But the mathematical Platonist is also gonna face that problem, right? So the mathematical Platonist might say, I have a really good explanation of how 2 + 2 = 4. And somebody might say, yeah, but you can't bump into the number 2. How in the world did your experience put you in touch with these abstract objects? It seems like it couldn't have. There's no link between you and this completely immaterial abstract object, the number 2. So how did that happen? And you can try to tell a story like that. I don't think it's very plausible, which is why I'm not a Platonist about any of these things. But at least I want to leave the door open for somebody to tell that kind of story. So if somebody's convinced that, you know, moral realism is true, but they don't want to concede that God exists, and they also want a theory, then say they give this moral Platonist view, we can say, well, we have a number of problems here. It's not as simple as our view and so on, but also how are you hooking up to these abstract objects? And then it can just be for them to explain. Where again, the theist has a much easier explanation, especially if we're, you know, if you posit that we're created in the image of God, or that God intends for us to be the kinds of things that would come to know and love him and enjoy him, then it just makes sense that he would put us within that kind of epistemic proximity to those kinds of truths. But on an atheistic view combined with moral Platonism, maybe the story isn't simple. It's not being simple doesn't mean it can't be told. It's just, it is a legitimate way to challenge moral Platonism, so.
Wouldn't a mathematical Platonist be comfortable with the idea that there's mathematical truths that are real that we have no access to?
Oh yeah, 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 sure. Yeah, yeah,
so,
but.
So then I feel it's not a.
Well, the moral
it's
Platonist.
It's not a complicated story of why do we have access to some of them. Well, some of them are helpful, we noticed.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
There's a vast infinity of facts that
yeah.
we have no knowledge of and never will.
Right.
And that's
right.
Fine.
Yeah, the moral Platonist could say the same thing, right? There might be so much of the moral landscape that we're never actually going to apprehend, that for all we know, it's just as extensive as the mathematical landscape. But whatever story you tell in the case of the mathematical Platonist, presumably, at least I don't see a reason why you couldn't tell the same kind of story for the moral Platonist, or indeed for just the Platonist, right? So.
But you need to have like a cause and effect relationship.
Yeah,
where
yeah.
Moral facts are causing things in the physical world.
But right.
Otherwise, because it's the usefulness that makes it functional in society.
Right, right. But you would say the same thing about mathematical objects, right? There's some sense in which 2 + 2 causing 4, or 2 and 4 and equality and addition and so on, that these abstract objects are related in such a way that they cause it to be the case that 2 + 2 = 4. That's a kind of causation, but it's not the typical, you know, one billiard ball hits another kind of causation that we think of as efficient causation. So you do have to try to tell a story that can link up that kind of purely formal causation, what Aristotle would call a formal cause, with a causal story you can tell about how we run up against these in our experience or something like that. But I'm just making the point charitably that it's not impossible that some story could be told like that. It seems highly implausible, And so I share your intuition that like it's probably a nearly hopeless project. I already think it's pretty hopeless to go this route of Platonism anyways, but at least we're putting on the table that there are options there, right? A serious atheist can think that moral Platonism is one of the options on the table, and then what we can do is just say, okay, that is an option. Sure, I'll just grant you that that's an option. Is it really as good as this option, right? And if it's not, then maybe you should abandon it for this one. So, yeah.
I had this question from a lady just today, actually.
Okay.
I've had this question, I'm going to tell you now, often. So talking about moral values and such, and she said, listen, I don't have a need for God. I have love in my heart, I have compassion for people. I'm spiritual. It's just too complicated for me. I don't see the value. So that's that value proposition, right? And I always find myself in a situation just nodding and saying, okay.
Right.
No, because I've nothing to add because she's right. You know, she's love in her heart and she's compassion and she's empathy and the law is written on her heart.
Okay.
But there's no need for God.
Right, okay. So this is really good because that's actually an excellent question because I should have said this earlier too. So it brings us back to this point. The argument that we articulated, so first premise that there are objective moral truths, second, if God did not exist, there would not be objective moral truths, conclusion, God exists. That argument is not an argument for thinking that you have to believe in God in order to be good. It's not even an argument for thinking that belief in God helps you to be good, right? This is not in any way the claim that belief in God is good for you, or it's something that will make your life better. Or maybe those are true, they might be, but those are completely immaterial for this argument. This argument just cares about whether you can infer God's existence from a commitment to objective moral realism. So the question is not, for example, do you have to know that water is H2O in order to drink it? No, you can drink it. You'll be just fine without knowing that it's H2O. But then if we're asking the question, what is water? And you come to the conclusion that it's H2O, and somebody responds to the scientific evidence for that by saying, well, that's not really a useful belief for me in my life. I get by just fine without believing that water is H2O. It's like, okay, then you're not interested in the question about what the nature of water actually is. But here, we're interested in the nature of goodness. If there are objective moral truths, then there has to be in the world some truth maker for them. And we think plausibly the best candidate for that, maybe not the only candidate, you could be a moral Platonist or opt for some other view, but probably the best candidate for that is just God. And that's already motivated for other reasons anyways. So the advantage of this argument, it kind of is a two-part advantage, actually. One advantage is that it takes an intuition that is very, very strong and cherished by most people, even if they don't do much philosophy, even if they don't have an account of objective moral realism, if you push them, most people are going to say, yeah, I want to be that kind of realist. I don't want to give that up. Right? I would only give that up if I absolutely had to. So this argument is using an intuition that is very well shared and very well supported in moral experience. But then the other advantage to the argument is that it actually illuminates a little bit more of the nature of God. So most of the other arguments that we use for God's existence are going to infer that God created the world, or that God has properties like being powerful, maybe that God has properties like being all-knowing, or something like that. But very often what you don't get to very easily in those other arguments, like the cosmological arguments, for example, is God's goodness, right? So some people will say things like, well, okay, you've convinced me that God exists, but why think that God is good? Right, or is worthy of worship or anything like that. Well, in a sense, the moral argument cuts straight to that one property. It won't give you every property of God. In fact, it probably won't give you anything more than just his being necessary and good. It won't give you his being all powerful. It won't give you his being, you know, omniscient or anything like that. But at least it illuminates this one thing that God has, which is goodness in and of itself. That God doesn't just happen to be good, he's the paradigm of goodness. He is that to which we refer when referring to goodness, just like H2O is that to which we refer when referring to water, right? Or in that same sense. Okay, all right, I think we've done enough for that for that one argument, and I'm glad we didn't rush through it. So we'll take a break, and probably about 10 minutes, and then we'll do the teleological arguments after.
Thank you for that.